are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS and the first of an entire summer of shows produced from all around the country during the Praxis Summer Roadshow. The interviews you're about to hear come from organizers and thinkers in Portland and Eugene, Oregon, and will all be posted in their full form at www.truthscout.net, along with photos, bonus interviews, writing, and more. I've embarked on this tour to talk to different people working in the United States and Canada about climate change, fossil fuel extraction and the resistance to that activity, alternatives to capitalism as a means to address climate change, living cooperatively, and the tension between reform and revolt in our culture. These first interviews span topics including collective education about climate, anarchist publishing, carbon sequestration in soil, building worker cooperatives and democracy in other avenues of life, and the ways that prisons, injustice, colonialism, and even civilization itself tie into the broader issues we face today. We'll start in Portland with Paul Messersmith-Glavin.
My name is Paul Messersmith-Glavin, and I'm part of the Institute for Anarchist Studies, which is almost a 20-year-old organization that primarily raises money to give grants to writers to support the writing process. So we try to fund organizers to write about their experiences. And we give them grants to give them the opportunity to take time off of work or hire child care so that they can devote themselves to writing. We also publish some books in a journal called Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. Here in Portland, I'm part of the Hella 503 Collective, which is a political collective that grew out of Occupy. We do work on immigration issues, climate change issues, against police brutality and anti-racism type stuff. And then I'm also part of the Parasol Climate Collective, which came together about 6 years ago after my wife Lara and I came back from a year in China, and started off as a study group looking at climate issues and then developed into an organization that gives educational events and talks to other organizing groups about how climate issues will impact their work. So climate work is one of my main focuses. That's primarily it, in addition to my work with the Institute for Anarchist Studies.
The main interventions people suggest for climate change are definitely state-based or market-based, both kind of scary options for me. What do you advocate as far as climate change, adaptation, mitigation, all of that? What are you guys mostly talking about when you look at those issues?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the root cause of the climate crisis is the economic organization of society, namely capitalism. And so then suggesting that the market can solve climate change is absolutely absurd, because mm-hmm. it's the very market society or capitalist society that is causing the climate crisis. Basically, by treating labor and the environment as resources, and basically discarding aspects of the productive process, which are called externalities, in a very unconscious fashion, at least unconscious about the effects that it'll have on the ecology. So to try to solve the climate crisis through the market is not going to work. The state, as it's now constituted, pretty much serves capitalist interests, mm-hmm. so believing that the state will intervene in the market to solve the climate crisis is also naive, I think, mm-hmm. and overly optimistic. The best that we can hope for is that the state will respond to a militant movement against climate change by offering reforms that will help slow down the process, but I don't think the state can ultimately solve the climate crisis. I think the only way that we can solve the climate crisis is by fundamentally reorganizing society so that we have a society that's run by the people themselves, so that the people who are impacted by decisions are the people making those decisions, and that we have an economy that takes into consideration the not the needs but takes into consideration the impact that those economic decisions have on nature and the ecological surroundings that sustain human life.
Sure. And that's, so you mentioned in your history, recent history, involvement in Occupy. That was my understanding of the prime, at least at the opening of Occupy, was like, let's talk about this great reorganization, you know, dissolving and rebuilding of something completely different, which kind of faded in many places. But it sounds like here, at least, that grew into a collective, Hella 503, that is still continuing that work. How are you working to make that possible, you know, to start to escape from capitalism, escape from the structures that we're in order to create a new kind of space?
Right. Well, it's taking on a lot of different fights, like the fight for immigration, liberation, so that people are freely to live and work wherever they please without being stopped by nations' borders, doing work to support immigrants and fight against attacks on immigration, and also doing work on climate issues by doing educational work and organizing work. Here in Portland, we got involved with a door-to-door canvas in a working-class neighborhood in North Portland called St. John's. And Hella 503 and Parasol Climate Collective and Portland Rising Tide and some unaffiliated organizers all got together, and we went door to door and knocked on hundreds of doors and talked to people about climate issues. And we asked people a number of things, including, do they believe that climate change is happening? And the overwhelming majority of people at the door believe that it's happening. And then we asked if they would support illegal action to stop climate change. And the majority of people said yes, as long as no one got hurt. And that was very significant and very important finding that we ran into, is that, like, everyday working people in this neighborhood in St. John's would support illegality to stop the climate crisis. So people understand how serious the issue is. And that represents a real groundswell of support for those of us who are organizing against capitalism and drawing the connections between the capitalist economic system and climate change. So we found that very encouraging. Part of that work also involved developing a curriculum, like a 5-session study group, and then like just 20 or 30 pages worth of readings and short videos that we handed out at the door, and we handed out about 60 of those.
Wow.
at the door, and formed a small study group with people in the neighborhood and organizers who came together for 5 or 6 sessions to talk about climate issues. So, I mean, all that was very encouraging, and it's not really glamorous work, but I think that's the kind of grassroots organizing that we're going to need if we're really going to mobilize people to stop capitalism, which is a huge request.
Something I've been focusing on, will be focusing on this tour and in the show in general, is the pretty stark news scientifically coming out in the last couple of years. It's been stark for a long time for people who are paying attention, but the paper coming out of Stanford about 6 mass extinction, just the evident heat this summer. You were saying this is our second over 90 degree week in Portland. It was over 100 most of my drive here today. People are aware of it on a visceral level. What do you think we can adapt in time, and how? What do you think is going to happen in terms of, and if we can't, should we still try? That's the sub question.
Yeah. I mean, I think this question, it is a question. It is a question of adaptation, because even if we were to stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere today, the climate change that we've already experienced will continue to happen, and the fluctuations in the climate will continue for hundreds of years due to the CO2 we've already put into the atmosphere. And until recently, the goal of the political elites in the world, along with the scientific elite, seems to be to try to limit the increase in global temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius, or about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And at this point, it looks like we're going to exceed that quite considerably. Something I do, I've given talks around the country on climate change and capitalism, and I've pointed out that this is the best case scenario that we've confronted with, is a 2 degree increase in temperatures. But in fact, at the rate of emissions that we're on now, which are not being reduced in any way, we're actually on course for a worst-case scenario. So what we really need to do is look at what the worst-case scenario is, because that's the scenario that we're living in, mm-hmm. which is, you know, potentially discouraging news, but also indicates the gravity of the situation. Because we're basically looking at like a 10-degree increase by the end of the century, which would be devastating. Because right now we have about a 1-degree increase, and we see like the droughts and the mm-hmm. heat waves and the typhoons and the hurricanes and everything that are happening with this very rather minor increase in temperatures compared to what will. Right. I think we have an obligation, in a sense, to the future and future generations to try. We're living in a very historically significant period, because what happens in our lifetimes will determine the future of human civilization for the next 100, if not longer, years. Hundreds of years. And I think if we don't really radically change direction in terms of our economic organization, really in the next, say, 5 to 20 years, things are going to be very bleak for the future. The future will increasingly resemble the worst dystopian science fiction stories that we've read. I just think that as things get more extreme in terms of the types of heat waves and things that have been going on, the more likely it is that more authoritarian solutions will be proposed by the government and by the state and by corporations, which will curtail people's freedoms and people's ability to enjoy life. And I think that the population will be more sympathetic to more authoritarian solutions as things get more disrupted and crazy. So I think what we need now is a more anti-authoritarian movement to take the momentum away from any kind of top-down authoritarian solutions. But I think it's essential that we do whatever we can in our lifetimes to make this change. That's something else I said in my last talk up in Seattle, is that we really need to dedicate our lives to this, because that this is the time in which those changes need to happen. If it happens when we're much older, it could be too late. So I think one thing that's really good is to use climate change as an argument for the current society as it's organized economically is changing the climate. And basically what we need to do is fundamentally reorganize society so that our everyday lives and global activities don't have such an impact on the climate. So basically using climate change as an opportunity to argue for a new society and then inviting people to think about what type of society they really want to have, like what kind of society do we really want to live in, and basically inviting people to envision that and talk about that and begin to dream again about the type of world that we want to live in, and to say, like, this is what we need to do, and actually we have to, because if we don't, the future is going to be increasingly grim. It's going to be more and more grim.
That was Paul Messersmith-Glavin speaking from Portland here on the first installment of shows from the Praxis Summer Roadshow. Again, you can hear that full interview and more about his work at www.truthscout.net, where I'll be posting longer content throughout the summer, as well as producing weekly shows right here on KYRS. I had a chance to reconnect with a former guest and fellow radio host at Anarchy Radio in Eugene, primitivist and anti-civ writer John Zerzan, about technology, connection, and climate change.
My name is John Zerzan, and I became active, first of all, in the 60s in San Francisco in a kind of do-it-yourself union, which was quite a laboratory for learning about organizing, since we had to kind of make our way against the powers that be, including organized labor. So it was very interesting times. And I was very interested, when I left that, I was pursuing the history of unionism and the role of unionism mainly as a kind of pacifying force. I was taking a kind of negative view of it. But that led almost right away to the question of technology, because part of that had to do with the first unions in England, in the textile industry, the first industrial enterprise, really, you know, 200 years ago or so. And the work I was doing on about technology came from not an original insight, but the idea that technology enforces certain values on people by its nature, and we tend to overlook that. We tend to look at it as neutral, well, it's just technology, but it really expresses the dominant values, and usually in a kind of carceral way, to use the Foucault term. But yeah, it's a double-edged thing. I mean, to me, what the thing is, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that technology has hollowed out society. It has isolated people. It's leading to more and more pathological behaviors, and like the mass shootings. That's something I've dwelled on quite a lot. You know, when people are just cut off from community, and community's really been virtually erased, you get these totally unconnected people who really have nothing to lose. We're seeing more and more of that, and it's in a rough equation, is that that just keeps happening, and so does all the rest of it.
Where's the balance between building something else to transition into, rebuilding different knowledge of ways to do things, and accelerating that process of stopping the destruction from all of these? We obviously have to stop the old and start the new, and I don't know, how do those interplay?
Such a daunting thing, because nothing has worked yet, although I feel like there's a lot of energy out there, and like we were just saying, there's quite a bit of receptivity, which we sometimes gravely underestimate. But, you know, you look for the touchstones. Where do we learn things? And I think the biggest thing to me is the indigenous dimension.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the traditional ways. And everybody, almost, well, a lot of people anyway, give lip service to that stuff. But it really isn't permitted in terms of what that would mean, what it would undo, what it would reject and get rid of, you know, and that's, so it's the positive and the negative. You're going to have both. You got to have, you know, you got to have alternatives. You got to have some connection to something practical. How do we feed ourselves? You know, I mean, you know, the obvious questions while you're trying to figure out what is the negative, how can you proceed against all these enemies, all these institutions, that all of which need to go, in my opinion, virtually everything you can think of. It's that total. I mean, that's the nature of this condition. And to just to go after one issue or whatever, it's way past that time. You know, I mean, I don't think it ever was that time, but that's just missing the boat altogether. But, I think for the anarchist milieu, or whatever we want to call it, it's what we can learn in conjunction with the Native folks who are trying to do stuff, and they are. I mean, just take a look at all the anti-pipeline stuff mm-hmm. that's going on in North America, and I've got friends in Arizona, Southern Arizona. It's just been an incredible privilege to learn stuff there, to be in some contact with the Ohotam people, for example, through.
Again, that was John Zerzan talking with me and Eugene. While reverting to more sustainable ways of living might seem daunting, many scientists and theorists have been thinking up creative ways to rebuild ecology as we wean ourselves off of industrial means by necessity. I caught up with Jordan Fink, a permaculturist and organizer in Portland, to talk about some of his ideas for cleaning up the planet.
Well, I'm Jordan Fink. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and over the years I've had a number of different hats and roles, but I've worked in nonprofits, I've worked in community organizing, and my current obsession is figuring out how human beings can actively be part of the repair process for the planet.
And how did that emerge, that aspect of...
Gosh, I mean, part of it was finding things like permaculture and ecological design when I was a kid. I used to kind of scour the library, read whole sections, and there was a day that I found the Permaculture Designer's Manual and just kind of sat down and digested it. Yeah, and that was really kind of the beginning of it, and there was a strong scene for permaculture in Portland that was nice in that it had no experts, no like superhero celebrity permaculturalists. So it was a lot of people who had homes, and Portland had been a settling spot in the 90s for people coming back from the Peace Corps. So there was a lot of people who were just sort of had seen traditional agricultural systems around the planet and settled in Portland and sort of tried to do some of that stuff in their own homes. I grew up with a lot of Peruvian flute music.
Right on. And can you, just to back up, can you explain, regular listeners will know, but for the uninitiated, what can you give like just a two-sentence definition of what permaculture is?
Yeah, permaculture is a curriculum that came about in the early 80s and late 70s that was attempting to take all of the ideas out of things like the Whole Earth Catalog or Mother Earth News, these ideas of ecological design, ecological restoration, and economic botany, those kinds of things, and trying to put them into a 72-hour curriculum that would teach. First, it was for the third and second world. Teach people how to quickly reassemble ecosystems to create food production and repair the land and be able to survive during rough times. It came out of Australia during the beginnings of the drought. And so it was a lot on fire prevention and restoring the function of ecosystems while feeding people. So the idea is that there doesn't have to be a conflict between people and land, that there can be a reconciliation, that humans need can be tied to repairing the planet. And
how does permaculture help us adapt to the climate changing so rapidly? I mean, we're seeing like within a span of every season, you know, which is only looking to accelerate.
Yeah.
In this part of the world, how do those principles address that in a way that maybe the systems we're using aren't equipped to do?
I mean, part of it is that we have to understand how change works in complex systems. Like, we have to look at the long view. So, like, when you look at the history of ice ages as they've come and gone in the last, you know, 20 million years since the Oligocene, and we know that species have set co-evolution, but then during those times of change, there's a scrambling that happens. Systems fall apart, and they reassemble in new ways. And permaculture is kind of about how do we look at what we have and assemble something quickly. One of the developers of it, Holmgren, calls it remedial holistics for post-industrial survivors. That's like the basics of what you need to know in order to assemble systems. And that means it doesn't have to just work for plants. It can work for how you think about things. And a lot of them are just really basic principles. Like, we talk about stacking functions so that every function that, or every element that you have in your system performs multiple functions. And that just means that you're being efficient, that you don't just, you know, everything that you do needs to pay off in multiple ways. It needs to support habitat, or it needs to fix nitrogen, or it needs to feed somebody, or it needs to block wind. And the more things you can get something to do, makes a lot of sense. And then the other one that we often pair with that is that every function should be met multiple ways. So where do you get your water? Maybe you get it from the city, but you also get it from the roof. And you get it, you have your plants be able to collect their own water because of the way you've shaped the land around it. So your garden gets its water maybe three or four different ways. If one of those ways falls apart or is unreliable, now it's like a table with three legs. It can actually stand. So those principles are sort of like ways of giving systems theory a shorthand for people. It's kind of was meant to be a populist approach to cybernetics, you know, helping people understand complex systems, but how do you actually just go do it? When you're looking at plants, you're only seeing the feeding parts of the plant parts of the plant that eat sunlight, and the parts that are reproductive, the flowers or whatever. Most of the plant is actually in its roots. That's a lot of what the plant is. And it is taking half of that and producing exudates, which are sugars, carbohydrates, proteins, and they're using those to feed microbial communities, bacteria, fungi. And they do that because those organisms can mine the soil for insoluble nutrients, and those are important for plants. It turns out there's not a soil on the planet that doesn't have enough nutrients. Most of them are locked in insoluble form. Our problem as a society is that we've gotten obsessed with solubles, because if you have dead soil, a plant can only use soluble nutrients. And so we pour those in the form of salts on the land. They all get into the groundwater, they salt everything, they eventually make out to the ocean, causing algal blooms, and hydrogen sulfide gas starts bubbling out of the ocean, and eventually we're in another mass extinction. And, well, we are at another mass extinction as we kill the oceans.
Yeah.
So what I started to realize, though, is like the soil's capacity to buffer carbon through these processes is pretty huge. And when you look at the numbers, you realize the amount of CO2 that's been released through fossil fuels is less than the planet's original buffering capacity. So let's say we just burnt this fuel and we didn't mess with the environment. That, I don't think, would have caused nearly the problem we've had. The real problem is that we use the energy locked away in the fossil fuels to dismantle the planet. We used it to pour chemicals on the soil, which killed the microorganisms, and we used it to plow and till, which moves lowland soils to the erosion level that usually is safe for alpine environments, like huge amounts of erosion. And we've basically destroyed the Earth's capacity to buffer carbon. So I've never felt like, or I don't feel like the fossil fuels are the problem directly. It was how we used them. And so that opens for me a hope, which is we're halfway through the fossil fuel supply. And if it really is in decline, which I think the more I look at peak oil, that is a legitimate way of understanding resource use. Mm-hmm. We are peaking. I just saw a report recently which was comparing outcomes now to the original limits of growth studies. Mm-hmm. And we're finding we're right on track.
Wow.
For what people were predicting, you know, in the old Club of Rome studies that were done. Mm-hmm. So we really are at peak resource, peak oil, peak energy. And the way I say it is, like, you got to put away your toys before you get sleepy. Like, in 20, 30 years, we're going to be using hand tools to fix things that were done with those giant machines that they use for mountaintop removal. Mm-hmm. We are not going to be able to take apart the plant. We're not going to be able to put the plant back together at the same scale that we've been taking it apart. Mm. And so when I get to the reality of things like, what are we going to do about nuclear waste? You know, I know you're from Spokane, so you're downwind of Hanford, and I'm downwater of Hanford.
Yeah.
We have to do something about this, and we can't do that with bicycles and hand tools. And we will have a society which will be using bicycles and hand tools. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which will be delightful in many ways, but not in terms of industrial scale problems.
Yeah, we have to put the planet back together. And we actually do know enough about how to get processes underway that fix carbon, that repair soils. We can take subsoil and inoculate it with topsoil, and we can build our roads and our houses and our structures so that it actually improves the distribution of water, so that soil can fluff, so that soil can, like, become better and increasingly improving. Mm-hmm. And it would only take... one of the things we know is that, if you look at the Dust Bowl, you know, in the 30s, huge amounts of topsoil blowing away in the wind, it oxidizes more CO2 than the entire history of motor vehicle use. The Dust Bowl is one of the major causes that ended up happening to bring about global warming. And I think we're seeing this again and again. So I made myself a promise a few years ago that I was going to have to take things seriously once I started seeing dust storms that rivaled 1934. And that was last year. Mm-hmm. Phoenix has had huge dust storms. And if you just turn the footage to sepia and put Woody Guthrie playing in the background, it could be 1934.
Logistically... what you're saying is that we have, like, scientifically it's possible to intentionally mimic nature's methods for carbon sequestration, pulling it back out of the atmosphere.
For not much oil, you can design and build ponds, roads, swales, access. You can design your buildings so that they all help spread water onto the landscape in a very controlled way. And with the right kinds of planning, you can, rather than using conventional plows, you can carve the land with what we call keyline plows, which shatter the subsoil and help hold water high in the soil and help the soil become inoculated with water. We can isolate the microorganisms and grow compost tea, very easy to do, and spray those on the soil and inoculate them. And then having the right relationship with grasses and other plants so that the microorganisms have a pumping of carbon into the soil. And there's people like Alan Savory who are practicing using cattle to do that. And there's a lot of people who are trying to debunk that right now. There's more and more scientific research that's showing that plant grazing can influence the sequestration capacity of grasses. And grasses are cool, especially perennial ones, because they can live up to 500 years, like the old perennial grasses. And they can go deeper and deeper, pouring more carbon into the soil.
That was Jordan Fink, and this is Praxis, bringing you the first dispatch from the summer-long tour of the U.S. and Canada, interviewing rabble-rousers working on climate and justice issues. You can hear the full interview I conducted with Jordan, along with many others, at www.truthscout.net. Part of what you'll hear is Jordan's plan to enact some of these ideas by building worker-owned cooperatives to repair soil. What is a workaround cooperative, and why should we use that model? I met up with another former interviewee, Daisy Montague, to talk about just that.
My name is Daisy Montague, and I'm in the activist crowd in Portland and in Olympia. So I would say I've been organizing and doing things since 2007. Then I got involved with the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW branch here. And that was pretty interesting because I always wanted to be a part of the IWW and didn't really think that that could exist now. And well, I was wrong, and the IWW did exist here, and they did, and are still doing some pretty awesome organizing. Mm-hmm. I'm no longer a part of the IWW, but still really respect what they are founded on and what they historically and currently are doing.
Cool.
Yeah.
And now. Yeah.
And now, in the vein of what the IWW stands for and how they organize in the workplace, we're doing something similar. We started a worker collective called Cascadia Collective Hood and Duct, and we have 4 members, 2 women of color, myself, I'm Latino, and Denise, she's a young black woman, and then we have also Adam and Rick. So it's our S4, and it's pretty awesome because we own this collective, all of us, and it's amazing because we get to see the fruits of our labor, and there is no hierarchy, there is no boss. We all own it, and we all run it democratically. And it's a really empowering and amazing experience to do that. So, yeah.
A lot of people who I talk to, and myself even included in this, really love the idea of, you know, escaping from capitalism, domination in all forms, and the rest. And a lot of people who are organizers are also still have one foot in, you know, quote-unquote, the system, are still working for a boss, are still engaged in all of that. How does that, like, the economic freedom that affords you related to, I guess, greater struggle beyond that?
Right, yeah, I think, and that's super interesting, because I think about this a lot, because especially, like, as a small business startup, we're very much beholden, and even when it becomes actually a successful business, we're still very much beholden to the capitalist system. You know, we have and work with all sort, you know, all everyone's a capitalist that we work with. So, but we provide a service, and so there's a certain sort of freedom in the way that we govern ourselves. Because it's democratically, and we don't have to submit to power every single day. When we go to work, we don't have to, you know, I want to cuss because I'm a cusser.
You care.
But we don't have to kiss anyone's ass, you know. We don't have to do and say whatever the boss would mm-hmm. like us to say. We don't have to, you know, manipulate ourselves to say the nice things or do exactly what they say. And so that's really, really amazing. When we have an issue, we have to communicate that with our fellow workers and say, hey, you know, and that organically arises, you know. Mm-hmm. there will always be problems, there will always be something that happens, but we don't have to submit our power every single day in the workplace and have the fear of losing our job because the person in power decides that they no longer want to deal with us, mm-hmm. or that it's economically better for them to get rid of us so that they can continue to exploit our labor in whatever manner or fashion they would like. We're not enriching one person. We are, you know, making a living for ourselves together. Mm-hmm. And that's what's, like, so amazing and powerful, is that when we go out to find customers or we go out and we work, we're enriching ourselves. That is what's up. That's awesome. Yeah. And yeah. So, like, that's the part that's powerful. But, like I said, I think that we're very much beholden to the capitalist system in many, many ways. And until there's more worker collectives out there and, you know, like, the rule would be cooperation and how to support each other, then we're going to continue to have to figure out and unfortunately appease the capitalist power in a lot of ways. Yeah. I think that when these sort of struggles are rooted in working class people's experiences, that changes the entire environment and the way that things are played out in the workplace. It really does. And people are more invested when they actually are given an opportunity. They're more invested in the bigger picture because they say, oh, because, you know, I say, I'm like, this is my one chance. This mm-hmm. is my one chance at a good life. So, you mm-hmm. know, like, I'm in it to win it. Like, I'm yeah. here for the yeah. fight and the struggle and to put everything mm-hmm. I have into it.
And it tends to be pretty, I don't think you can go back from experiencing an actually democratic, small d democratic, like direct democratic participation in a workplace or in a home even, or, mm-hmm. and then I think it ruins your taste for accepting less than that. Mm-hmm. And right. that's really hopeful, right? To like mm-hmm. see that for people and the notion, just the confidence that it would build for people. Yeah. Because that's a huge part of the problem is that people don't have belief in themselves a lot of the time. I think, I observe this a lot, that people don't think they can do something like that,
right?
Let alone like.
And why would you, right?
Yeah.
There's, I mean, the system currently, right now that we operate under and we unfortunately just barely survive. But the system that exists now is just pushing us down and is designed for us to fail.
Mm-hmm.
There's no two ways about that. So when you have an alternative to it and a well thought out one too, it's, you know, it's an opportunity, it's a chance, it's hope, mm-hmm. you know, it's a lot of things. And when people, if it's well thought out, people can plug in and say, oh wow, like I haven't even thought of these things before.
Hmm.
It's really powerful.
Yeah. Daisy's right. Making those connections is really powerful. And I, for one, am so excited to see what connections are made through the rest of the summer. I finished up my time in Oregon talking with Adam Carpinelli, an organizer and one host of the Prison Pipeline Collective show on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. We talked about the ways that colonialism and state repression feed into a broader pattern that destroys the health of humans and the rest of life on Earth.
My name is Adam Carpinelli. I am based in Portland, Oregon, and I am the National Secretary for the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoner Amnesty, and we have a Portland-based chapter called Oregon Jericho. I also work with the Portland Anarchist Black Cross and several other collectives, such as the Prison Pipeline Collective at KBOO Radio in Portland, and also work locally in a coalition that intersects issues around Palestinian solidarity, political prisoners, migrant immigrants' rights, and native rights, among other things.
So it all comes back, obviously. We want to struggle for justice, for organizing our society outside of hierarchy and domination. Mm-hmm. I think at least you and I can agree on that, and I hope yeah. that other people listening do too. I'd assume if they're listening, they've come yeah. that far with me so far.
I hope so.
But but all of it, I mean, we can't take care of one another if the, you know, if the planet can't sustain human life anymore.
Right.
And that's kind of what we're looking at. So how, in your approximation, does all of this, you already mentioned colonialism being a component, but how does prison work and kind of direct struggle with the state relate to mm-hmm. climate change?
Sure. I mean, I think that as far as the way that people are organizing around climate change, that maybe one angle that might be useful is to look at, you know, and not to sound like some kind of hippie Buddhist or whatever, but the interconnection of all things, right? And in a scientific sense, that's kind of mm-hmm. what biology tells us about nature anyways, right? Is that it's this spiraling kind of fractillian cycle of life, you know? And so you take away one thing and then, you know, that's how it goes. So the way that human beings have related to the environment, maybe more in the recent last couple hundred years, like we've gone through some really radical transformations, you know, into capitalism and industrialism, you know, looking at maybe like if we want to take 1492 as kind of a baseline for a lot of antics, you know, that have really affected the world in incredibly radical ways and have continued to exacerbate aspects of climate change and environmental devastation, you know, whether it was like colonial monocropping on plantations or what have you, right? But again, there's the connection between not just the environment, you know, how did those people relate to the plantations, but obviously how did they relate to each other? Mm-hmm. Now, in that case, we're talking about slavery. So those relationships were based on complete domination, right? Systems of domination and these kind of relationships of oppression and, you know, white supremacy and imperialism. And we still have all those today. And so they've culminated in themselves from slavery times into what we now call, you know, the prison industrial complex, mm-hmm. among other things too. But when we look at prisons, okay, you know, how are people relating to each other in the natural environment? Well, if you ask me, they're not relating at all, period. Okay, on a couple different levels. And so on a human level, the idea with prisons, which I don't think is the case, is, you know, quote-unquote correctional facilities, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, that term wasn't even used until some really major prison insurrections that happened in the 70s. And then all of a sudden, you know, you see how the state started kind of, oh, well, no, we're correctional facilities. We're really trying to, like, help people and rehabilitate people, mm-hmm. okay? But we know that's not happening. We know that we have, you know, high rates of recidivism. We know we have high rates of incarceration when you break down the demographics, right? You know, it's predominantly people of color. When we look at populations of Native American folks who might come off like fairly low in the national average of U.S. population, at the same time we look at the prison population, and then it's very, very, very high. Okay, and also just to mention too, again, that, you know, Native people, indigenous people to the Americas, you know, we're always here first. And how come we don't know the name of that group of people? Can you tell me the name of the group of people that greeted Columbus when he was lost in the Caribbean? And many people don't know that. Some people do, but a lot of people don't know that. And it's important to note that, though, because, again, there's the whole question of land. It always goes back to land and colonization and how we relate to those things. And not to romanticize indigenous culture anywhere in the world in space and time and just say, oh, everybody was totally in touch with nature, but we know that it was a lot more sustainable, you mm-hmm. know, and that a lot of societies weren't, you know, completely top down in the way that the colonial system exacerbated all those relationships in the Americas. So what I'm saying is the connection of all things is the connection of people to people, connection of people to land, the connection of to people to non-human species, you know, and how all that relates. And so we look at prison industrial complex, and it doesn't show that we have found human ways to relate to each other for what we now call like restorative justice. And that should be the whole ball of wax with prison. You know, prison should be, which I don't really believe in prisons anyways, but if we're going to use the idea of, you know, having some kind of institutions in our society, then, you know, they're going to be used for education. They're going to be used for rehabilitation. They're going to be used to strengthen the pride and dignity of any, you know, human being. And what's going to happen in turn, though, is that people will also have, like, more dignity about their immediate environment. I mean, that's the whole environmental piece. I mean, that's why I talk about it that way. That this is how we have to learn how to relate to ourselves, which we're not doing very well, you know, in order to really relate in a lot of ways to the environment and to, like, non-human species. However, time is running out.
A stark finish there, but as we all know, time is running out for humans to begin to act in radically different ways, to act as though we want to survive and thrive on this planet. That's all for this first hour of broadcast from the Praxis Summer Roadshow, but I hope you'll check in online, join the conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/praxisradio, and hear these extended interviews and more at www.truthscout.net. Thanks to the crew at KYRS for helping me make all this possible, and to you all for listening. So here I am, 4 days into this long summer, and already feel like I've been gone a long time. The mission of this journey is to interview activists, organizers, and average people from all over about climate change, fossil fuel extraction, and the movements of resistance to that extraction, alternatives to capitalism, models for living and working cooperatively, and the atmosphere of change as it varies from place to place. I'm recording today from Dunsmuir, California, in the shadow of Mount Shasta, a place that boasts about having the best water on Earth. After a few days of intensive interviews and a lot of driving, I'm ready for a couple days of restorative mountain time. The headwaters of the Sacramento River, one of the largest in the West, are nearby. The water there takes years to reach the surface, filtering up through the mountain before it spills out in an unassuming stream that eventually builds into a powerful river. People have been gathering at the headwaters for thousands of years, and the healing and spiritual properties of the water there have been spoken of for most of that time. As I prepare to head into the heart of the serious drought affecting the West, I'll bring a little bit of it with me for luck, or something. I'm not the only one with my eyes on it, though. Crystal Geyser has recently built a facility here to bottle the water, part of a worldwide effort to privatize water sources. I'll be posting more links and information about that issue on my blog for people who are curious about finding out more. I spent the first 2 days of the Praxis Summer Roadshow in familiar territory, mostly in Portland, Oregon. There, and in Eugene, I conducted 5 interviews with activists and organizers working on issues ranging from climate change education to permaculture design, to democratizing workplaces, to supporting political prisoners, to questioning the model of civilization itself. The common tie between these conversations ended up being anarchism, which makes sense, though it wasn't fully intentional. If you listen to Praxis regularly, you've probably picked up that I'm also an anarchist and have attempted to dispel some myths about anarchist ideas over recent years for the local audience. It isn't surprising that many people misunderstand anarchism. Even the dictionary definition focuses on synonyms like chaos and disorder. The true root of the concept, though, is in radical democracy and building a world without hierarchy, ideas that most people support when described in different words. Any truly grassroots organizing that builds consensus among a group of people based on the needs and values of the group is, whether labeled this way or not, anarchistic. There's an ongoing tension between radical visions like these that demand we change not one policy, but everything about the way we relate to each other and the planet, and the liberal tradition of attempting to improve upon mass institutions one piece at a time. One macro focus of this series is this tension between reform and revolt as we accelerate toward ever more dire outcomes of our growth and domination-based models of life. Spending so much time in a car has given me so much to think about, including the car itself. As I burn up fossil fuels to explore the destructive power of fossil fuels, I wonder about the contradiction that's present in so much of what we do as we try to help make the world a better place. I want to start giving people rides along the way, but for now it's been just me and my thoughts and a whole lot of strange talk radio and guilty pleasure pop music. Individualism, another thing I'm not crazy about, along with cars, has been part of the story too. Alone in a car, among other people alone in cars, in their own worlds, lacking a lot of connection to one another and especially to the planet as you zoom by all of the land that changes around you. A person like me could lose their mind thinking about the history of this country, and that's even more true when you're driving along the fateful route of Lewis and Clark, past dams, nuclear waste, and agricultural dust storms. I'm thankful that I brought along a CD collection of Howard Zinn's People's History of the 20th Century to keep me company and remind me that I'm not, in fact, insane for thinking that a lot of this wasn't the best idea. So now we're looking at how we can go forward in a different way that's a little bit healthier for each other and the planet. I'm glad to do this work, and especially to bring the rest of you along for the ride. From here, I'll be heading into the Central Valley and then east into the desert to see parts of the country I've never seen, and for the first time, fracking up close and personal. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 90.